Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we have stories from Dorothy Gundy and Dan Friedel. Later, Ashley Thompson and Ann Ball discuss some new words from dictionary.com. And we close the show, as always, with an American story. But now, here's Dorothy Gundy.
Vietnam's government lifted the ban on a popular anti-war song after just one day of public outcry. On April 11th, Vietnam's Department of Performing Arts announced that the song Noi Van Thai Lan, or The Great Circle of Vietnam, could no longer be broadcast or played in public. The song was written by Chinh Khon Song more than 40 years ago. It is about wishing all the people of Vietnam could hold hands in a circle large enough to cover the whole country. This is An Li singing the song. Ching wrote hundreds of songs, but this song may have been the most popular. During the war, the song became a call for the North and South of Vietnam to reunite. On the day Saigon fell in 1975, Ching sang the song live from the official radio station. After the war, Ching spent several years in a re-education camp in Vietnam. He died on April 1st, 2001. But his songs remain popular throughout Vietnam and the global Vietnamese community. He has often been compared to American songwriter Bob Dylan. Wen Dang Chung is head of the Department of Performing Arts in Vietnam. He explained the ban to local media. Even though the Great Circle of Vietnam is very popular and has been played in many meetings and entertainment programs, in fact, everyone sings it without permission. The ban came soon after the government had banned five other love songs popular in the South during the war. But banning the Great Circle of Vietnam may have been a step too far, judging by the large protests on social media. Chin's sister, singer Chin Vin Chin, told the local media the family was surprised at the government's response. The family also requested to play the song as a tribute at the Hue College of Medicine and Pharmacy later this month. Phu Quang is a Vietnamese songwriter. Many of his songs are about love and the city of Hanoi. He told VOA that he didn't understand why the song was banned. He said, "There is a power stronger than the law, the people. Anything the government does that is unreasonable, they will not let it stand." On April 12th, Vietnamese media reported that Wen lifted the ban because the song has good content. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Earlier this year, many tennis fans were talking about the Australian Open finals. American tennis stars and sisters, Serena and Venus Williams, played each other in a so-called Grand Slam final for the first time since 2009. Serena beat her older sister in two sets to win the Australian Open. Little did we know, Serena was in her eighth week of pregnancy at the time. This week, she posted a photo of herself wearing a yellow bathing suit on social media. On the photo, she wrote, 20 weeks. Fans immediately started talking and debating. Was Serena pregnant? A spokeswoman later confirmed Williams' pregnancy. She also confirmed that she would not play in tennis competitions for the rest of the year. The spokeswoman said Williams expects to return to tennis in 2018, however. The baby is due sometime in the fall. Williams is set to marry internet businessman Alexis Ohanian. Williams has not played since her win at the Australian Open. She reportedly had an injured knee. The younger Williams sister holds the most ever Grand Slam singles titles. Her win in Australia moved her ahead of Germany's Steffi Graf. Many people could not believe Williams was able to win a major tournament while pregnant. Comedian Trevor Noah joked Williams had an unfair advantage in the match against Venus. She was actually playing doubles tennis, while her sister was playing singles. Another person joked, Williams's fetus is already ranked 200th in the world in tennis. I'm Dan Friedel.
Welcome to another edition of Words to the Wise. Languages, as you all know, are always changing. Last month, we learned about some new words that the American dictionary Merriam-Webster added to its online dictionary. They included conversational words like photobomb and binge watch, along with scientific words like propopagnosia. Dictionary.com also announced that it added new words to its online search system. 300 of them, to be exact. I have Anne Ball here with me in the Learning English studio, and we are going to explain and discuss some of these new additions. Hi, Anne.
Hey, Ashley.
So, Anne, I know you looked into some of Dictionary.com's new word choices. What can you tell us about them?
Well, first, I can tell you that I can't tell you about some of the new words because they are inappropriate to talk about on the air.
Uh-oh. Well, let's only talk about the ones that are appropriate or okay for broadcast.
Well, of course. So there are a lot of them. It would take a lot of effort and time to learn them all. You may feel like you are on the struggle bus if you try to study all of these new words at once.
Struggle bus? Are you describing a vehicle that is having trouble operating, or is this one of those new expressions?
Oh, well, you've got that right. You guessed it. It's one of Dictionary.com's new entries. Struggle bus is a slang expression. It describes a situation that seems difficult or frustrating, such as trying to learn 300 new words all at one time.
That would be difficult. You know, I feel like I'm on the struggle bus today. It is probably because I didn't eat breakfast.
Oh, well, are you serious you didn't eat breakfast? Well, what you need now is a superfood. That is another of Dictionary.com's new words.
Superfood. That sounds like you might need to put a superhero's cape on your dinner table.
Well, not exactly. A superfood is any food that has a lot of vitamins and nutrients. It is very good for your health and helps your immune system. Some superfoods are kale, blueberries, and pomegranates. They're all delicious. And eating superfoods could help you slay the day.
Help me slay? That sounds a bit violent, Anne.
Well, yes. To slay literally means to kill by violence. But as a slang expression, slay means to impress or to do well and be successful.
I have actually heard this one before. People say it when someone says something really funny, too. For example, you might say, "Your joke slayed me."
Yep, and you know, if someone has a smart or just really funny response to someone, they might use another one of Dictionary.com's new phrases, mic drop.
Okay, so mic is short for microphone, right?
Yes, a mic drop signals the end of a winning performance or even a statement. It means nothing can top or better what was just said or done.
Okay. So often it is done as a gesture, right?
Uh-huh.
A person will hold their hand out and pretend they are dropping a mic or microphone. I remember former President Barack Obama did it at the end of an informal and funny speech he gave at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
I remember that. That's right. And the origin goes back to the 1980s. Competitive rap artists would drop the mic when they believed they had won the rap contest. And comedians, people who tell jokes, also would sometimes drop the mic at the end of a performance, kind of like saying, "I'm done."
Yeah, of a really good performance, probably.
Right.
Well, so mic drop shows a lot of confidence.
Exactly. But a mic drop could lead to a smackdown.
Again, with this violence.
The verb smack does mean to hit someone or something with a lot of force. But as a slang expression, a smackdown means a sharply critical comment. It might be hurtful to someone, or at least hurt their image.
Well, Anne, maybe we should end this Words to the Wise here before one of us slays the other with a smackdown.
Oh, that's a good one. I'm Anne Ball.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And now it's time for an American story. Today we hear The Caliph, Cupid, and the Clock by O. Henry.
Prince Michael of Valleluna sat in the park on the seat he liked best. In the coolness of the night, he felt full of life. The other seats were not filled. Cool weather sends most people home. The moon was rising over the houses on the east side of the park. Children laughed and played. Music came softly from one of the nearer streets. Around the little park, cabs rolled by. The trains that traveled high above the street rushed past. These cabs and trains, with their wild noises, seemed like animals outside the park. But they could not enter. The park was safe and quiet. And above the trees was the great round shining face of a lighted clock in a tall old building. Prince Michael's shoes were old and broken. No shoemaker could ever make them like new again. His clothes were very torn. The hair of his face had been growing for 2 weeks. It was all colors, gray and brown and red and green-yellow. His hat was older and more torn than his shoes and his other clothes. Prince Michael sat on the seat he liked best, and he smiled. It was a happy thought to him that he had enough money to buy every house he could see near the park if he wished. He had as much gold as any rich man in this proud city of New York. He had as many jewels and houses and land. He could have sat at table with kings and queens. All the best things in the world could be his. Art, pleasure, beautiful women, honor. All the sweeter things in life were waiting for Prince Michael of Valjaluna, whenever he might choose to take them. But instead, he was choosing to sit in torn clothes on a seat in a park. For he had tasted the fruit of the tree of life. He had not liked the taste. Here in this park, he felt near to the beating heart of the world. He hoped it would help him to forget that taste. These thoughts moved like a dream through the mind of Prince Michael. There was a smile across his face, with its many-colored hair. Sitting like this, in torn clothes, he loved to study other men. He loved to do good things for others. Giving was more pleasant to him than owning all his riches. It was his chief pleasure to help people who were in trouble. He liked to give to people who needed help. He liked to surprise them with princely gifts. But he always gave wisely, after careful thought. And now, as he looked at the shining face of the great clock, his smile changed. The prince always thought big thoughts. When he thought of time, he always felt a touch of sadness. Time controlled the world. People had to do what time commanded. Their comings and goings were always controlled by a clock. They were always in a hurry and always afraid because of time. It made him sad. After a little while, a young man in evening clothes came and sat upon a seat near the prince. For half an hour he sat there, nervously. Then he began to watch the face of the lighted clock above the trees. The prince could see that the young man had a trouble. He could also see that, somehow, the clock was part of the trouble. The prince rose and went to the young man's seat. "I am a stranger, and I shouldn't speak to you," he said. "But I can see that you are troubled. I am Prince Michael of Valjaluna. I do not want people to know who I am. That is why I wear these torn clothes. It is a small pleasure of mine to help those who need help. First, I must feel sure they are worth helping. I think you are. And perhaps your trouble may be ended if you and I together decide what to do about it." The young man looked up brightly at the prince, brightly, but he was still troubled. He laughed then, but still the look of trouble remained. But he accepted this chance to talk to someone. "I'm glad to meet you, Prince," he said pleasantly. "Yes, I can see you don't want to be known. That's easy to see. Thanks for your offer to help, but I don't see what you can do. It's my own problem, but thanks." Prince Michael sat down at the young man's side. People often said no to him, but they always said it pleasantly. "Clocks," said the prince, "are tied to the feet of all men and women. I've seen you watching that clock. That face commands us to act, whether or not we wish to act. Let me tell you not to trust the numbers on that face. They will destroy you if they can. Stop looking at that clock. What does it know about living men and women?" "I usually don't look at that clock," said the young man. "I carry a watch, except when I wear evening clothes. I know men and women as I know the trees and the flowers," said the prince warmly and proudly. "I have studied many years, and I am very rich. There are few troubles that I cannot help. I have read what is in your face. I have found honor and goodness there, and trouble. Please accept my help. I can see that you are wise. Show how wise you are. Do not judge me by my torn clothes. I am sure I can help you." The young man looked at the clock again, and his face grew darker. Then he looked at a house beside the park. Lights could be seen in many rooms. 10 minutes before nine, said the young man. He raised his hands and then let them fall as if hope had gone. He stood up and took a quick step or two away. "Remain," commanded Prince Michael. His voice was so powerful that the young man turned quickly. He laughed a little. "I'll wait 10 minutes and then I'll go," he said in a low voice, as if only to himself. Then to the prince he said, "I'll join you. We'll destroy all the clocks, and women too." "Sit down," said the prince softly. "I do not accept that. I do not include women. Women are enemies of clocks. They are born that way. Therefore, they are friends of those who wish to destroy clocks. If you can trust me, tell me your story." The young man sat down again and laughed loudly. "Prince, I will," he said. He did not believe that Prince Michael was really a prince. His manner of speaking proved that. "You see that house, Prince? That house with lights and 3 windows on the 3rd floor? At 6 tonight, I was in that house with the young lady I'm going to... was going to marry. I'd been doing wrong, my dear Prince, and she heard about it. I was sorry. I wanted her to forget it. We're always asking women to forget things like that, aren't we, Prince? I want time to think, she said. I will either forget it forever or never see your face again. At 8:30, she said, watch the middle window on the 3rd floor of this house. If I decide to forget, I will hang out a long white cloth. You will know then that everything is as it was before, and you may come to me. If you see nothing hanging from the window, you will know that everything between us is finished forever. That, said the young man, is why I've been watching that clock. The time was past 23 minutes ago. Do you see why I'm a little troubled, my torn prince? Let me tell you again, said Prince Michael in his soft voice, that women are the born enemies of clocks. Clocks are bad. Women are good. The white cloth may yet appear. Never, said the young man hopelessly. You don't know Marion. She is always on time to the minute. That was the first thing I liked about her. At 8:31, I should have known that everything was finished. I'm going to go west. I'll get on the train tonight. I'll find some way to forget her. Good night, Prince. Prince Michael smiled his gentle, understanding smile. He caught the other's arm. The bright light in the prince's eyes was softening. It was dreamlike, clouded. Wait, he said, till the clock tells the hour. I have riches and power, and I'm wiser than most men. But when I hear the clock tell the hour, I'm afraid. Stay with me till then. This woman shall be yours. You have the promise of the Prince of Valueluna. On the day you are married, I will give you $100,000 and a great house beside the Hudson River. But there must be no clocks in that house. Do you agree to that? Sure, said the young man. I don't like clocks. He looked again at the clock above the trees. It was 3 minutes before nine. I think, said Prince Michael, that I will sleep a little. It has been a long day. He lay down on the seat, as if he had often done it before. You'll find me on this park on any evening when the weather is good, said the prince. Come to me when you know the day you'll be married. I'll give you the money. Thanks, prince, said the young man. That day isn't going to come, but thanks. Prince Michael fell into a deep sleep. His hat rolled on the ground. The young man lifted it, placed it over the prince's face, and moved one of the prince's legs into an easier position. Poor fellow, he said. He pulled the torn coat together over the prince's body. It was nine. Loud and surprising came the voice of the clock, telling the hour. The young man took a deep breath and turned for one more look at the house. And he gave a shout of joy. From the middle window on the third floor, a snow-white wonderful cloth was hanging. Through the park a man came, hurrying home. Will you tell me the time, please? Asked the young man. The other man took out his watch. 8:29, and then he looked up at the clock. But that clock is wrong, the man said. The first time in 10 years. My watch is always... But he was talking to no one. He turned and saw the young man running toward the house with three lighted windows on the third floor. And in the morning, two cops walked through the park. There was only one person to be seen, a man asleep on a long park seat. They stopped to look at him. "'It's Michael, a dreamer,' said one. "'He's been sleeping like this in the park for 20 years. "'He won't live much longer, I guess.' "'The other cop looked at something in the sleeper's hand.
"'Look at this,' he said. $50. "'I wish I could have a dream like that.'
"'And then they gave Prince Michael of Valueluna a hard shake "'and brought him out of his dreams and into real life.'
I'm Katie Weaver. Tune in tomorrow for another Learning English program on the Voice of America.